Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you here on this Getaway Friday, January the 20th, 2023, 17 minutes past the hour. And we have got a very historic, important hour for you here this morning. I'm very excited about this because this is a real touchstone for the next 45 minutes here on this station. As many of you know, of course, Monday was Martin Luther King Jr. Day, federal holiday here in the United States. And this year, if you don't know, is the 60th anniversary of the very famous, maybe the most famous speech ever written and recited, the I Have a Dream speech. Now, we have had our guest this hour on before. It's been a few years, but I'm so glad he's back today because he was the personal counsel, draft speechwriter, and friend of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and worked with him on the very famous I Have a Dream speech 60 years ago. What a pleasure it is to welcome to these microphones, as it always has been in the past, Clarence B. Jones. Mr. Jones, how are you?
Hi, how are you, Scott?
Good to speak with you. How are things out in on the West Coast?
Well, you know, we have been experiencing a considerable, you know, those people who follow radio and television, a lot of rain, but it's where I am in Santa Clara County in Palo Alto, California, which is, I live directly across the street from the Stanford University campus. So it's better. It's not going to be any rain today, I understand. And so, you know, it's a good day. Any day you wake up, that's a good day.
Absolutely. Mr. Jones, when you look at this week, the week of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, what does that day and this week mean to you from somebody who knew him?
Well, you know, Dr. King on January 15th would have been 94 years of age. January 8th, the week before, 2 weeks ago, I just celebrated my 92nd birthday. So I know that we're talking about the March on Washington 60th anniversary coming up on August 28th, 19, in the latest year. In a word, I don't have to say, you know, it's obvious to anyone who's, I don't know, what age, Martin Luther King was a transformative figure. And in my opinion, probably with the, in terms of the civil rights issue and also bringing together the coalition of African Americans and the Jewish community, probably the transformative figure in the 20th century.
When we think about the man, the guy you knew who was not the man who was giving speeches or at the pulpit, what was the guy like that you knew, the friend?
Well, he was brilliant. He was deeply a religious person, but he was religious not only in his spiritual commitment, but he was encyclopedic in his knowledge of both the what we would call the Christian, the Bible, but he was also familiar with the Jewish Talmud, and although I never heard him speak German, he had a reading ability in German. He was familiar with people like Hegel and the very learned person. He was afraid but fearless, deeply religious. In fact, it was the depth of his religion. And now I'm paraphrasing his own words, his belief in his own Jesus Christ that enabled him to survive. Because I used to think he was, I used to think he was crazy. Or he was just totally oblivious of morality, of reality. But as I became closer to him, I became to understand this was no act. He was the way I can, the best example is, we talked to Andy Young and other people around him, and Clarence, he says, I know you're my lawyer, and I know Stanley Levis and other people. I know you want to protect me, but you can't protect me. Only my Lord Jesus Christ can protect me. And I know you want to call the Attorney General and God. They can't protect me. Only my Lord Jesus Christ can protect me. Because he was a deeply religious person. I was raised to, this is an interview about him and not about me, but from the age of 6 to 14, I was raised by Catholic, Irish Catholic nuns from 11 months a year. So I understand the depth of religious training because I was subject to that from the age of 6 to 14. And so we are the benefit. America is the beneficiary. I don't know what he would think about. I mean, I'm writing my memoirs, and so I was saying to someone, I'm getting into some controversial areas because I talk about the black on black gun violence and what I call the black killing fields. There's so much gun violence, but particularly the escalating of gun violence in what I call the black community. Now, we know there's been a historic issue between the black community and the police, and that has significantly improved. Came to a high point on the issue of George Floyd. But what has gotten less attention is this off-the-wall violence, this craziness. Gun violence, and I have no way of calling. I call it the black killing field. Blacks on black killing one another. Nobody wants this. Nobody, either political leaders are too afraid to talk about it, or embarrassed to talk about it. But it is a reality. And yes, we have had a historic issue between the African American community and the police. That's a matter of historical fact. But now, What I see in getting not the appropriate attention I think it should get, it's just young black men just killing one another over nonsense, gun violence, and so I call it like the black killing field, and political leaders, particularly political leaders from the African American black community, they're either, maybe they're intimidated or they're uncomfortable talking about it. But I'm not intimidated and not uncomfortable talking about it. It's one thing to talk about the undeniable fact of the historical instances of excessive use of force by police in the black communities over the years. That's a matter of documented facts. But it's also an emerging documented fact that it's like open frontier of gun violence in our major cities: Philadelphia, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, and Oakland. It's sickening. Mm. And political leaders seem unwilling or unafraid or maybe uncomfortable and how to talk about it. Well, I'm neither unafraid or uncomfortable because it's a fact. If we don't stop killing one another, who is going to stop killing us?
Mr. Jones, I want to come back to something you said earlier. You said that Dr. King would say, Clarence, you know, you're my lawyer, you can't protect me, the Attorney General can't protect me. Then came that unfortunate day, very young in his life, 1968, in April, where he was assassinated.
Age of 39.
How would he have coalesced his Lord protecting him when that horrible event happened?
Well, it is an external event that occurred. That it occurred in no way diminished Dr. King's belief in his paraphrasing him, his Lord Jesus Christ. He would. And now I'm being asked to be very cautious here. This is Clarence Jones interpreting. He would say, well, it came a time when he wanted to call me home. Now, the fact that somebody blew his brains out in Memphis, he would say, well, that was my time. Now, I know that's, I'm not uncomfortable saying that because I was fairly close to him. He wasn't suicidal. That's not what I'm saying. But I'm simply saying that at the end of the day, in his own mind, he knew that when it was his time for the Lord paraphrasing him now to call him home, however violently that transition may have taken place, it was his time. And nothing that Andrew Young, Jesse Jackson Jr., Clarence Jones, or Stanley Levinson, or whoever, or Billy Cobb, or nobody could make any difference. It wouldn't have made any difference. But the important thing, he left an important legacy. I mean, let's not forget here. You know, it's not a speech that I had the honor of contributing the first 7.5 paragraphs. He literally, aside from Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, Martin Luther King Jr., in 12 years and 5 months, from 1956 until April 4th, 1968, when he was assassinated, may have done more to change and transform America on the issue of race relations than any other single person or event in the 400-year history of the United States. As I said, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation.
Mr. Jones, I want to come back. Yeah.
No, I mean, putting it in a colloquial term, he was a bad dude.
I think most would agree with that. And I think the other point you were making there about African-American crime and things going on, I want to bring one issue up here because I think this is kind of interesting because I know Dr. King and the gentleman I want to talk about here lived in the same time and had popularity in that time, and that's Bill Cosby. And a lot of conversation is brought up about Bill Cosby because of all the good things he did. Clean comedy, TV shows that people love, teaching people, donations to colleges, all the things he did. Same thing with Dr. King. And through wiretaps that were illegal, for the most part, I believe, there were some things that came out about Dr. King. I don't think we have to rehash those, but people are aware of those, I think. And, of course, Bill Cosby has run into some trouble, accusations, here in the last 10 years. Do you think Mr. Cosby's color and his position in this country had anything to do with his imprisonment?
Mr. Cosby was indicted, convicted, and then released from prison for breaches of the criminal justice system, acts which he was prosecuted for, and for which I guess one, he served time, I don't have the fact in front of me, served time, and maybe one of his convictions were overturned. But the fact of the matter, those events occurred. You can't erase that. Okay? Now you can try to make Bill Cosby and the Cosby Show, you make him a non-person, and make the Cosby Shows a non-event, but you can't. They occurred, and at the time they occurred, they were the most extraordinary form of comedy featuring African Americans on network television that had ever been seen at that time, thanks to Brandon Tartikoff, who was the head of NBC programming. Now, and so, Dr. King, it is a, it has been established as a fact that he had extramarital affairs. We can't change that. Okay? Those are facts. You have to weigh the occurrence of those facts within the total context of the person. And I must say, you have to weigh, although the two are entirely different, you have to weigh the context of what Bill Cosby has been accused of and has been what has been proven to have occurred. You have to weigh that within the context of the entire person's life. Or the way I like to put it, does Bill Cosby's going to jail for what he did, actually or alleged, and both, does that make him a non-person? Do you just, is that, does he and his life and his contribution, comedy, the justice becomes a blank space? It didn't occur. No, you can't do that. You may not want to give him credit because of what he did, but in fact, what he did in network television is an indisputable, unchangeable fact. And you want to go back and reevaluate and say, well, I love the Cosby Show, but now I don't like Bill Cosby because what he did. Well, that's an issue for you to resolve. But it doesn't change the existential fact of the extraordinary nationwide popularity of the Cosby Show. Similarly, it has been established that Dr. King had relationships with other women outside of his marriage. Oh, you have to weigh that. All right? Does that mean that the work that he did to enable the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 1965 Voting Rights Act, they don't mean anything now, because Dr. King wasn't through his life? Well, that's one position you can take. But another position you can take is that those things which Dr. King did with other women outside of his marriage, those were facts that occurred. Those facts do not extinguish the facts of other things that he achieved. So one has to measure. Are you going to say, well, I don't care how many people celebrate Dr. King's birthday. I don't care about the 1964 Civil Rights Act, because Dr. King was not faithful to his wife. Okay. That is a position that one can take. I don't care how great the Bill Cosby Show of Lawrence Oliver. I don't care, because he did such and such. That is a position that one can take. But it doesn't diminish the actual fact of the Bill Cosby Show. It doesn't diminish the actual fact that for 12 years and 4 months, Martin Luther King Jr. transformed and transfixed America in no other way since the presidency of Abraham Lincoln and the passage of the Emancipation Proclamation. Those are incontrovertible facts we cannot change.
When we look at the whole picture of the United States of America in 2023, we run through all of the holidays, July 4th, national holidays, July 4th, Memorial Day, Labor Day, Christmas, all of these things. There is only one day that I can find, and that would be the day we just passed, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, in which the day has been erected for a person who lived within the last century who people actually know. You're one of those
people.
That's correct. What would he, and I know this is one of those questions again because he's not here to tell us, what would he have thought about that?
What would he have thought about what?
The day.
The commemoration of a day in his honor?
National holiday.
Well, I think he would have looked at it less in personal terms than in terms that it was less, although it may bear his name. I think he would have looked at, in fact, I know I can say for certainty, he would have looked at the designation of a national holiday as really a commemoration to the struggle of what took place during the course of his lifetime. He would have looked at it less as a personal tribute to him and more as a tribute to the monumental coalition. By the way, a lot of people don't know that the heart of that coalition was between the so-called Negro leadership of the so-called Negro community at that time, the African American community, and the Jewish community. That's not generally known. It's not generally appreciated that as brilliant as Dr. King was and as committed to everything we worked with him and we followed him, there's no way that 12 to 14% of the population could have changed America without a substantial base of support within the white community. And that substantial base of support came first and foremost from the Jewish community. I write about it in my memoirs. You know, I used to think that all white people looked alike. You know, until you got up close and personal, you say, you know, yeah, they do look alike from a distance. But there's some white people who may have white skin. And, you know, white people, like black people, have different gradations. You know, people come from the Mediterranean, the white, particularly from Sicily and Italy and so on. But generally, when you get up close and talk to people who are Jewish, who have white skin, and when I came to say, I said, why are you doing this? Why don't you pick it up? Why are you doing so? The common denominator from men and women would say, you know, Mr. Jones, I'm doing this because this is what I think my grandparents would want me to do. And the common denominator of the reference to their grandparents was always a grandparent who has experienced the Holocaust. This is what my grandma would want me to do because of their experience in the Holocaust. That was fear of contradiction. Now, that was the overwhelming majority. I'm not saying that every single Jewish person who I talked to said that same thing. What I am saying, that the overwhelming majority of them that I spoke to always referenced their commitment to their belief in what Dr. King was doing and their belief that they thought that this is what their grandparents would want them to do. And so this is why in the latter part of my life, I have been, wherever I have an opportunity, I talk about what is not generally known in the general community. I talk about the extraordinary coalition that existed between the so-called Negro community and the Jewish community that enabled Dr. King to have the success that he had. Or stated another way, there's no way in hell that we would have been able to successfully achieve the enactment of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, had it not been for the active 24/7 coalition participation between, quote, then the Negro leadership and leadership in the Jewish community. It simply would not have happened. So that I say to younger generations of black people today, in case they don't know it, I say, you not only have a debt of gratitude to Dr. King, but you also had a debt of gratitude to the American Jewish community. Because if it hadn't been for the Jews who were most active and worked with us, we would not have been successful. And that's why it pains me to the point of craziness. But I hear people like Kanye West and other people peddle this anti-Semitism, even to the point of insanity, of questioning whether the Holocaust actually occurred, which is absolutely insane. And so, among the other things, I'm so delighted that you still remember me, Scott. I'm sorry. I'm glad that you haven't gotten so old that your memory hasn't faded. that you remember that there's this old black guy here on the West Coast that I once talked to.
You know,
let's see whether he's still alive.
Well, we have had, and I didn't count them up, but you've been on several times in the last 10 years, and I've always thought we have had some of the best conversations about this, because one thing, this is your friend, and there's no doubt about it, Dr. King, but you have been willing to talk about his affairs and what he might think, and I think that's important, because I think when you block that out, it just makes it worse. A non-answer is not good.
It's dishonest. To do so denies reality.
Right, right. And I think it brings us to this point, and this is another one of those supposition questions, but Abraham Lincoln did a lot of great things, but was assassinated. Even more so with JFK, only president for 3 years, did some good things, assassinated, but he always ranks, specifically JFK, in the top 10 presidential lists on President's Day. If Dr. King...
always ranked.
Well, usually,
sorry?
I say JFK is usually in the top 10.
Okay, yeah. I understand.
So, if Dr. King had not been assassinated, and I'm sure we all wish that he had not been, if he had lived to 80 years old, died of a normal illness, even though he did all the great things that we know he did, would there be a Martin Luther King Jr. Day?
I think more likely than not, yes, there would be. I think there would have been an effort if he had lived longer. And nevertheless, to put a capstone, a national capstone, on his life. Now, I want to make it very clear. In my lifetime, I mean, I was a young man, 1945, just starting high school, when President Roosevelt died. So the greatest president in my lifetime was President Lyndon B. Johnson, without question. Okay. I don't even have to think about that twice. Okay. He's the greatest president of my lifetime. And yet, he was the one that I was most critical of. I guess the dialectic of that is, he's the one that I remain today the most critical of, but at the same time, he remains the one that I have the most respect for. And the reason I have the most respect for it is because that white Southern president, he understood the use of power. He understood the use of power. There's this written by, I'm getting old, I can't think of his biographer, it was superb. Anyway, they talk about Richard Russell and President Johnson having this confrontation, and Richard Russell, who had been in the Senate, major powerful senator from Georgia, said to Lyndon Johnson, you know, if you pass the Civil Rights Bill, you know, you're gonna lose the South. And Johnson says, well, what's the sense of having power if you don't use it? You know, Johnson, you know, the day after John F. Kennedy was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963, Dr. King and I met that following day, all day at LaGuardia Airport to try to draft a statement that would be appropriate. And after giving deference to the undoubted loss of the Kennedy family, among one of the things we concluded in the 4.5 hours we spent at Kennedy, LaGuardia Airport, drafting and thinking about what the recent assassination of Kennedy meant, was he developed the theory in which I, in discussion, helped him develop, that it was unlikely going forward from that date, from Kennedy's assassination, it was unlikely that there would be any fundamental change on the issue of civil rights unless it was under the leadership of a black, of a white Southern political leader. We came to the conclusion it was unlikely there would be any transformative change on the issue of civil rights for Negroes that we refer to ourselves unless it was under the leadership of a white Southern political leader. And history proved the accuracy of that. A combination of Bill Clinton and from Arkansas and Jimmy Carter from Texas and George Bush Jr. from Texas. But towering above them all, Lyndon B. Johnson, the greatest civil rights president, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln. Well, I would say the greatest civil rights president. I'll leave it just as that. I was fortunate enough to have, I wasn't alive at the time of Lincoln, obviously, but I was fortunate enough to be alive at the time of Lyndon Johnson, and one of his most public, and remain to this day, one of his most severe critics on several issues. But my criticism doesn't blind my intellect to know that on the civil rights issue, there's no American president. And I include Barack Obama. I include there's no American president that was that enacted such transformative civil rights legislation or exhibited such leadership on the civil rights issue as Lyndon B. Johnson, that white Southern boy from Texas. He got it right.
You know, that's an interesting point, because when Dr. King is assassinated in 1968, we know that Lyndon Johnson is not going to run for re-election. Bobby right. Kennedy gets assassinated later that summer. We have right. Richard Nixon come in, who Dr. King knew somewhat well. Richard Nixon right. has his Watergate scandal, first president right. to ever leave the office. We get Gerald right. Ford, who was never elected, who pardons Nixon. A lot of things right. happened in the next 10 years. Do you think that Dr. King, had he lived, would have ever gotten in the political arena? What would a 70-year-old, 60-year-old Dr. King have been doing? Certainly different things than when he was in his 30s, I would think.
Well, I'm frequently asked that. I think he would undoubtedly have been, you know, like he would have been possibly the president of a university or the president of a foundation. It's conceivable that he could have even run for office. I mean, could have possibly even run for senator. This is all speculation. I don't know. But I do know this, that he was overarching in his transformative leadership. And in some ways, a political office would be too restricted. There was no office that could contain the magnitude of who he was. You know, by definition, if he became a senator, the office of the Senate was too restrictive to reflect the magnitude of his national leadership. That's another. This is Clarence Jones' opinion, a okay? But we don't have to. It's interesting to have this kind of speculation. But we have, we have the legacy of this man's leadership. And I know we're getting near the end of our program, so I'll just say this. No one, no single person in my lifetime, and as I said, I just celebrated 2 weeks ago my 92nd birthday, no single person since the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt was more transformative on the issue of civil rights than Martin Luther King Jr. And no person who held elective office as president was more powerful than Lyndon Johnson. And you are hearing this from the mouth of one of Lyndon Johnson's most superior critics, that's me.
We've got about 10 minutes left here, Mr. Jones, and I want to come to the I Have a Dream speech, because 60 years, right, this August, we will celebrate that anniversary. You were there when that was being put together. You were helping. You were right there with Dr. King. How much of that speech was on the page important, and the delivery of it, which was certainly spectacular, was important?
Well, first of all, my contribution to the speech really was limited to the first 7.5 paragraphs. That's my contribution. But the March on Washington in 1963 occurred on a Wednesday. A Wednesday, August 28, 1963. Tuesday evening, after Dr. King had met with some of his advisors at the Willard Hotel, he was tired. And I had known in working with him over the years that he didn't need me or anyone else to write speeches for him. He was perfectly capable of writing his own speeches. But there were two sources of income to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. One, the speaking fees he got when he spoke, and he would speak 4 days a week. And the other would be mail-in contributions to mail solicitations that went out. Now, if you're speaking 4 days a week, and you also have to be in your daddy's church on Sunday, you don't have time to sit down and make thoughtful speeches. And similarly, we knew that once the decision had made that there was going to be a march on Washington on June 21st, earlier that year, we knew that he was going to speak. And I knew in working with him that his greatest problem in terms of speeches, I had absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with his sermons, nothing whatsoever, But in speeches that he gave in response to numerous invitations to play organizations or major events, I and Stanley Levinson played a major role. And so I just happened to be with him at the Willard Hotel, and knowing that his difficulty always had, at least my observation, was how to start a speech. Once he got into it, he was into it. So under the pressures of the time, I had simply drafted on yellow sheets of paper the suggested text of what he might consider using in opening his speech, because it was like a security blanket. So I knew if he had that, he would take some of the pressure off. Now, little did I know, until I actually heard him speak. When I listened to him speak, I said, "Oh my God!" My first reaction: he must have really been tired, because when I listened to him, I said, "Oh my God, he is actually using the suggested text that I suggested he consider." So the bottom line is that the first 7.5 paragraphs of the I Have a Dream speech are exactly the word that I crafted. He didn't change a sentence, a period, or nothing. He didn't change one word. It's only the first 7.5 paragraphs. And then he begins it. And whether, but he, in fact, he added his own extemporaneous text of the speech when he was interrupted by his favorite gospel singer sitting on the platform. Harry Jackson says, tell it to him. Tell him about the dream, Martin. Tell him about the dream. And I was standing behind him, and I watched him push the written text of the speech that I just said. I drafted the first 7.5 paragraphs. He pushed that to the side and looked out at the crowd, and the rest of the speech, a lot of people don't know this, the so-called I Have a Dream speech, the rest of the speech after Mahalia Jackson shouted to him, tell him about the dream, and after he was reading from that text, the rest of the speech was extemporaneous and spontaneous. He wasn't reading from any text. He already put the text aside. So the entire speech thereafter, and that reference to I Have a Dream, that was all extemporaneous.
Mm. Well, the first, from the man yourself who crafted the first 7.5 paragraphs that he did use before he did it extemporaneously, what were you trying to say in those paragraphs? Because it has become, if not the most famous speech of all time, certainly one, you know.
We had in April of 1960, I'm trying to remember the exact date, we had crafted a long memorandum to the president in which we urged him to take major executive action on civil rights. We had prepared a very large memorandum to the president urging him to enact civil rights by the stroke of a pen. So Judge, we were trying to. We had this experience with Kennedy was president, and so what we sought to do, particularly since, you know, in Birmingham, I had to go and raise money, and I went into the Chase Bank owned by the Rockefellers, and had to take, and they gave us $100,000. And so I never will forget that experience of going to the Chase Bank to get $100,000 to take down for bail money. And I never will forget, it had a searing experience on me. So when you look at the first 7.5 paragraphs, I talk about being at the foot of the great emancipator. I talk about we're assembled here today to redeem a promissory note that has come back, a check that has come back unpaid, marked insufficient funds. Because I had to promise, when I had to go and take $100,000 from Chase Bank to raise bail money, I had to sign a promissory note. I had to actually sign a promissory note as evidence that this is where the money went. So I had that experience. I had that experience of actually going into the bank. Of course, the vault of, we can't believe that the vaults of justice have insufficient funds. Okay, so it was that experience that weighed very heavily on me as I crafted those first 7.5 paragraphs.
And the final question today, as we in the program here. 60 years ago, this August, that speech was delivered. We've had President Barack Obama. We had things like The Cosby Show, number one show, African American Family, in the 80s and 90s.
Right.
We've had movie stars, things of that nature. But then we've also had things, as you have spoken about, violence, Kanye West, his things as of late, and other things that have happened. 60 years later, Is the dream, has it happened? Been accomplished?
The dream remains, to paraphrase Langston Hughes, deferred. And the reason it remains deferred because can you believe that here in what day, what year is it, 2023, that we're still having issues over voting rights. We're still having issues over unimpeded. We're still having issues of whether there will be total access to voting, that this still remains an issue in various legislatures around the country. And it convinces me, it can only confirm what history shows. At the end of the day, voting is about power. Those legislatures that try to restrict or deny the opportunity for African Americans to vote fully, they know what they're doing. They know precisely what they're doing. They know that if you have unrestricted access to the ballot, game over. And so they want to try to restrict. I mean, I can't believe that it shouldn't be just in the opposite direction. There shouldn't be a monumental national collective effort in every state to make voting possible. I don't understand why they don't have a national holiday. Why don't they say voting to be a national holiday? Okay? When you go to vote, it's a holiday. You don't have to go to work. There won't be any impediment to your getting to the polls. On the contrary, various states still today want to make as many obstacles as possible on the simple exercise of the right to vote. Mm. So I appreciate you remembering this aging 92-year-old black man, Scott. I appreciate you having me on your program. But I have no illusions. I'm not stupid. I know you don't have it on me because I'm cute, which I am cute. You have me on here because I commend you. This is your form and your radio station's form of paying tribute to Martin Luther King Jr. I just happen to be a beneficiary of your commitment to do that. And I want to thank you and your station and your audience for enabling me to be a beneficiary of that, because I know it's not about me. It's about your effort to pay tribute to Martin Luther King Jr. with his pluses and minuses, with his warts and garlands and flowers. And so I thank you for having me on.
I can't thank you enough. Mr. Jones, we got 30 seconds left here. I'm going to toss you a long ball before we go. Just because it's been asked so many times, and from you, not from anybody else or any supposition, do you believe that former President Trump is a racist?
Well, that's do I believe the former president? Well, you know, you got to be careful how you use these words. And I'm careful. I mean, I could respond and say quickly yes or no. But I believe that former President Trump is a white man who was challenged on the issue of race. And I don't think that on a racist measurement scale, that he is, you know, I mean, I don't know where he goes from a scale of 1 to 10 on racism, but he sits within the scale of a white man having limited or no experience of the black experience, and having engage in several instances of acts which have to be called racist, and then in other instances having reached out to leaders of the black community. So I'm very cautious about using that characterization. Personally, pushed to the wall. On a comparative scale, I believe that as a white political leader, he is more racist than not.
Mm. Clarence B. Jones, personal counsel, draft speechwriter, first 7.5 paragraphs of the famous I Have a Dream speech 60 years ago, and has been a great, great friend to me. And Mr. Jones, as you had said, certainly we bring you on to honor the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., but that was the first time. The other times have been that, but also because the conversation is frank, candid, and honest, and boy, I certainly appreciate it, and this is not the last time. We'll do it till you're 100.
Okay, got it. From your mouth to God's ears, brother. Hey,
thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Clarence Jones, hope you enjoyed that. We'll be back in, what do we got here, about 15 minutes.
The Talking Place.
Hi, Grandma. What's for dinner?
Hey, honey, I'm making stew tonight.
Ooh, can Nina come over?
I'm not sure about her.